you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello again from the Game Developers Conference. My name is Jason Schreier, and I'm joined, as always, by Maddie Myers.
Hello, I'm here.
And right now we are joined by the co-founders, but not really co-founders for reasons we will get to, officially titled Worker Owners of Glory Society, a brand new studio. But you may know them more from their previous game, Night in the Woods, Scott Benson and Bethany Hockenberry. Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you both for coming on the show.
We're actually only two out of three of the Night in the Woods team, and two out of three of the co-founders of Glory Society.
Oh, man. Well, we only have four mics here. So.
Okay. Well, she's also in Colorado right now. So,
okay. Yeah, we'll try to Skype her in later to make it complete. Thank you guys so much for being here. One of the things that's really interesting, and the reason you're not really co-founders of Glory Society, is that you guys are starting a co-op studio. And just to give us a little context here, because this is what we're going to talk about, what can you guys explain what that means exactly for people who might have no idea what a co-op is?
Worker cooperatives. There's a few different kinds of cooperatives. Usually when people think of co-ops, they're like, oh, that store that sells like granola down the street or something. That's like a consumer cooperative,
well, no,
right?
People here are just thinking of like Anthem, like, oh, that's a, yeah.
Co-op, yeah, it's co-op, yeah. Playing, God, we should have, like, that's going to be the future of like game cooperatives. Okay. They're all going to be like plays on like, you know, that kind
100%.
Of thing.
Like three
time three to play party. Co-op, and it's like, you know, a bunch of people grabbing controllers. We were joking that like we're like the worst thing about trying to popularize this is like someone's going to call it like boss skip or something. It's just going to be loads and loads of
amazing.
You don't even need to. Co-op is already a gaming
term. Yeah, it's true. Well, there's already a cooperative named co-op up in Montreal.
Yeah, with a K.
Yeah, with a K and
so,
an underscore in the middle.
Okay,
so yeah, I should probably talk about what that is. So, like I said, most people think of like consumer cooperatives where you go to like a grocery store and you buy like a membership and you can kind of like attend meetings and have some sort of say in what happens.
Uh-huh.
And that's what a lot of cooperatives in the U.S. are, but the worker cooperatives are kind of a different animal completely. It's a business that's kind of owned, operated, controlled completely by the workers. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no one up top calling, like, all the shots.
Bobby Kotick would not be pleased.
We tried to get him to join, but he wouldn't return our calls, and then I got punched by a security guy, it was bad. But the we'll get him. But the... so it's, you know, you make decisions, democratically by votes. We have like a big list of like bylaws, of, like how we deal with certain things and all that, which is good because you want to get that out of the way at the top.
Everyone gets paid the same.
Yeah. We like negotiate that, you know, we control all what happens to all the profits. So, like, workers get all the profits too. Mm-hmm. So, there's no one person making the decision on all that. Like, we have budget meetings and we talk about it. We know what everyone makes, salary wise, because we have to talk about it and negotiate it. We have to look at, and anyone can see the budget and what we have in the bank at any time. And we can discuss that, you know, we can talk about, for example, after GDC, when we get back, I'm going to be like, I could use a couple days off and we'll talk about that, you know? So there's that, another big, principle of cooperatives is kind of like one person, one vote. So if you have like, let's say like someone who's kind of like acting as like your art lead, kind of like pushing the, you know, vision for the visuals of the game. And then you have someone that's kind of like working with them. Like, the art lead doesn't get like five votes in our, when we're deciding like business stuff, you know, they still only get one.
So what made you guys decide to do this, to start this co-op?
I mean, probably, I think our main thing is we didn't want to be bosses.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because fuck bosses? Like, I mean, that sounds...
You're speaking to two, like, managers.
Yeah, sorry.
So.
But we are in a union.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah, no.
So we're middle managers, so it's okay.
Yeah, well, someone pays you, right?
Yes,
someone,
yes.
And there's someone above, like, you know, if, you know, all the thing that happens to, like, media in the past, like, year or whatever, that's not coming from you two. You know, that's that's coming from people.
Yeah.
I'm actually secretly the CEO of Univision.
Okay, cool.
$10 million a year.
All right. I'm actually the CEO of Univision.
I'm actually the CEO.
Some real Spartacus shit happening.
But yeah, so like bosses in the sense of like owners, like people at the top who are like skimming off all that like surplus value off of you know, the employees below, and then making decisions for everyone kind of beneath them. And that's we just didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. We're both in like our mid-30s. We both had a whole bunch of jobs from like service industry, like home healthcare, up to doing like client work and design work and animation work. And we just done it enough by the time we were in a position where we needed to start like a studio to make our next game after Night in the Woods. And we had a little bit of like funds to, you know, invest in that. We were like, God, do we want to be bosses? I mean, we'd be really cool bosses, but do we want to do this? Do we want to have... And, you know, when we started talking with Ren, who's a brilliant artist, super cool, great musician and everything, we're like, I don't want to be Ren's boss. Ren means as much to this as we do. Like, why the hell would we perpetuate this shit? Like, when we don't have to. When we don't have to. Like, you know, not everyone has that choice, but we had the choice because we were starting something. And a lot of other smaller studios also, it's something that could be on the table for them, particularly if they're just starting up. But also, if they're not, you can transition into something like
so
this.
So it's the three of you? Are there more people, or is it just
the three of you? Yeah, it's three right now.
Okay.
Probably
we're
going to
be staffing.
Like
we're probably going to like expand to about five.
Yeah. Well, so the immediate question that comes to mind is just knowing the tiny bit I do about game development, talking to game developers, it seems like one of the biggest blocks in game development is not having someone make a decision. Like, you'll have a meeting full of people and everyone will be like, I think it should be this. I think it should be this. And ultimately there has to be someone who makes a decision. How do you guys, like you said, that you all make decisions together, but in practice, like, does that work? Like, how does that actually come down to it?
It does. You kind of just need to. And as with everything, like, yeah, you could get a whole bunch of people who are just like being dicks, or a whole bunch of people who are just not compatible with each other. But that's going to happen in any sort of business.
Sure.
That's not a unique thing about cooperatives. Because we've been asked this question a few times before. I think it's largely that, like, when we envision how these things work, we do think that there needs to be kind of like we did an interview last week and someone was like, where does the buck stop? Who is the last person that makes the thing? And the answer is like all of us, but we each have kind of different things that we do. We talk about horizontal organization and vertical deployment, which is a great, like, very businessy way of describing it. And what that kind of means is, like, Bethany's, like, our financial officer, right? And, like, not, like, officially. There's no, like, no job titles in it necessarily. But Bethany's watching the budget. She's making sure payroll goes out and that sort of thing. But any of us can go and talk to Bethany about that. And when we're making big financial decisions that affect the whole co-op, we sit and talk about it. But we also defer to Bethany on some of that stuff because Bethany's watching that. Mm-hmm. I'm acting as sort of a creative director on the game. Which doesn't mean like I'm like, you know, enforcing this like vision, but I'm kind of nudging us towards like a shared vision and that we've kind of agreed on and we're talking about as we vote and as we go through things. And so, you know, when Ren draws things, like we're not all sitting around like, you know, being like, all right, well, you place that branch a little weird. Well, let's all vote on it or something. you know, a lot of it's just communication and a lot of it is knowing, you know, like those kind of final calls you can build consensus on. It's not quite as like amorphous as it sounds, because I think people are used to this very chain of command type thing. But you can, you know, through like organizing, you know, yourselves, you can have some sort of trust in what other people are doing and talk to them if you need to.
Well, so what I'm envisioning, just like hypothetical situation, right? So I'm envisioning a situation where you all have like great chemistry. You all have the absolute best intentions in mind, right? But you disagree with some fundamental decision. Like, will our next game, I don't know what your next game is, but is this game going to have a jump, right?
Yeah.
And maybe there are four of you at that point and two of you are like, yes, it needs to have a jump, otherwise it can't work. And two of you are like, no, I can't have a jump. This game can't have a jump button, right? Who decides? Like, is it because you're like the de facto creative director that you're going to be like, look, we got to push this way, or do you just sit at a stalemate because it's 2-2?
Well, part of the thing is that like those kind of conversations where you're evenly split on like a really core thing are rare. Like they're very rare, at least from most people in my experience working on projects. Like there's usually some sort of consensus and you can compromise, you can talk, and there might be a little bit of, I don't want to do this or something, but you can come to a consensus. Like, and that is partly depending on like personalities and all that kind of stuff. But again, that happens in any sort of business. we have votes too. So it's like we need 60% for this, 75% for this. So like if all else fails, we can just vote, you know, and people have to deal with that. But we are very, very dedicated to be like, let's try to find a consensus of some sort so we don't have to do that kind of thing. But if it comes down to it, we have all kinds of procedures for dealing with just that if it comes down.
So what happens if you're hiring some freelancers or part-time workers to help you with certain parts of a game?
This is funny. This is also one of like the main questions that we get. I think like five people asked this at the panel yesterday.
Because
I did contract work for like 10 years since back doing in like animation and like directing and stuff before we got into games. So there's no like exact rule like in co-ops. There's no like co-op law that gets handed down to you or something. So I think everyone handles it a bit differently. So when we bring someone on, right, like we have to think about like what our core, like what we do. So like, let's say all four of us are starting a pizza place, right? Let's do that. By the way, we're all starting a pizza place.
Okay. It's real now.
And all of us.
I think it should have a jump button.
Okay, cool. Well, fuck you. All of us are making pizzas. We just want to make pizzas or something. And all of us put in money to buy an old storefront on Main Street and we name it. What's the name of our pizza place?
Kotaku Pizza.
Kotaku Pizza. SJW bullshit pizza.
Pizza Taku.
That's the motto of it, but it's called Kotaku Pizza.
Kotaku Pizza, SJW bullshit pizza. Yep. But anyway, that was ironic, listeners. We all start this, right? And we all make pizzas, and we each bring something to it, and that's just what we do, right? And we're starting to sell pizzas and everything, but we don't know how to paint our sign or make our neon thing or design our menus or something like that. So we're going to have to go work with someone else to do that. It's basically the same thing as this. We have our own internal like ideas of, again, having been contractors. It's like pay promptly, pay well, credit prominently, reasonable timelines, tons of communication, just like we're doing. Communication is, as you could probably tell, the key to all of this. And there's also something where you have to recognize, because what a lot of places are doing, I don't know if you've noticed this, is essentially having a load of freelancers just as the workforce, right? And I think there's probably one of the things that people are going to have to watch out for. One of the things I've heard about other co-ops is you have to watch out for starting to be like, well, there's three core members of us, but most of our stuff is made by this workload of freelancers.
Right.
And that's just something
then
you have to...
the bosses.
Yeah, that's how you... and just something you have to watch for. So, like, I think the core cooperative team are the people making the pizza and the people who are kind of part of this core business, you know, people who are doing all that stuff. But there are going to be times when you're like, oh, we need to design furniture for our showroom. None of us know how to do this. And we're not going to bring on someone full time to manage to do furniture forever, right? Because unless they can also make really good pizza, you know.
Yeah.
We have our own kind of internal ideas on like how to treat that and how to handle it. But you also just have to keep yourself accountable to not become, just not just start exploiting people. Because all of this is set up to just exploit people. Like, this is one of the reasons why we wanted to do this cooperative, because it's like stepping back from some of those structures that are just inherently exploitative. And so when it comes to contractors and freelancers, which again, like, it's like we need like a tuba solo for the soundtrack or something. It's like, we could either learn tuba or we can go like and, you know, pay someone in to do a tuba solo.
So, do you have bylaws or something whereby you allow people to vote on what we should pay these freelancers and what their conditions should be?
Oh yeah, like, no. Any sort of financial decision we come together meetings periodically and just be like, all right, here's what's, you know, we have to talk about software. We have to talk about, you know, like, oh, we're going to show this at PAX. Do we want to show this at PAX? Who wants to go? How are we paying for it? Where are we staying? That's all just conversations. That you have. So that's
like
a larger
get
conversation.
Significantly harder the more people were involved. I mean, like, we're
that's
in a
the
union,
biggest question is scaling.
Kotaku's not that big, but all the other sites at Gizmodo Media Group, it becomes a lot of people.
But even with us,
building consensus can be difficult.
With 17 or 18 people at Kotaku, like,
it's very difficult.
You need someone ultimately coming down on decisions, especially when you're doing something fast paced as game development can be. And yeah, it just seems really tough to scale. But I guess you guys don't want to scale. You want to save five people? Is that the plan?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that we've also been asked a lot is just like, well, you can't get big. And it's like, we don't want to get big.
Yeah. We don't really
want
this
to be sustainable.
So it's the type of model that works if you don't want to get big.
There are ways co-ops have worked to make it larger.
Yeah, there are structures to make this larger, too.
And there's co-ops that are larger.
Yeah.
Like, So yeah. I know Steve from Motion Twin yesterday at the panel. It was great because he was going over like, here are all the downsides and complications to this, which is fantastic. Because we're all up there being like, this is great and stuff.
Yeah. Well, his studio has been doing it for a while. But they're also like 15 people?
They're 10, I believe now. And
this is the Dead Cells people.
The Dead Cells people. You might have heard that game. I hope it finds an audience someday. They found, I don't want to speak too much for him, but just going by what he said, that there's kind of an optimal like 7 to 10. Uh-huh. And I think it's in part because of just how they work together. He was saying, I think in the talk yesterday, he's like, yeah, once you get past 10, you can't just shoot a Nerf dart at someone across the room and be like, oh, hey, let's go talk about this or something. Mm-hmm. But there are structures for doing it larger where, you have like smaller teams and the people who direct those teams are voted on basically. And they can kind of go back and forth and you can have that. There are co-ops that work that way. Mm-hmm. I think the only difficulty with that can be making sure that everybody feels heard and for a kind of creative decisions. But that is a lot of how you organize yourselves, how kind of diligent you are in making sure that you're communicating and working together. We always joke when we were going through like our 15 pages of like operator agreement that goes into like such minutia on all of this stuff is a lot of this stuff is if we're talking and we're reasonably chill with each other and we trust each other and we're open to communicating and we keep that open, then this all runs pretty well. Like a lot of these rules are like, what if someone's a dick?
Right.
Or something. Yeah. Or what if someone murders someone and we had to figure out what to do about that? Or if they've somehow embezzled a bunch of money.
I hope that's in your bylaws.
Yeah. We do actually. It is.
Really?
It is. Yeah.
What happens?
We have terminatable offenses, right? Okay. And like one of them's like breaking the law.
So you murder them,
or something.
Saying.
Yeah. We all get together. There's chanting and crying and murdering. But then we're reborn after that. There's a whole process for onboarding and offboarding people, and you hope to never have to do that. But there's processes for all of that stuff, and so a lot of that's worked out. So you can theoretically expand it very large, but there just aren't a lot of cooperatives in video games, and so it's one of those things of like, well, sure, possible, just no one's done it yet, because a lot of this is pretty ground floor as far as like it's like there've been worker cooperatives in games for a while and a lot of places that essentially operate like them but aren't legally technically that. It's possible. It really depends on the team and what you're doing.
It seems tough. There are a lot of things about this that seem really tough, but one of them that comes to mind is if everyone's being paid the same salary, then it's tough to bring in someone who might be making way more at another company and like get the most talented programmer from someone else or get the most talented animator who might be able to make twice as much elsewhere. Is that a challenge that you guys are...
That's a challenge for any small business, though.
I mean, that's not any different. If we weren't a co-op and it was just us, we still wouldn't be able to do that.
So yeah,
that's fair.
Really, yeah.
It's not like, something that... Then the other part of this equation and something that I've been wondering is profit sharing sounds awesome. It sounds like everyone who worked on a game should be able to reap the benefits, right? But what happens when a couple of you were there at the very start and then you hire someone who comes on a month before it shifts?
We got bylaws.
So what's your plan? It's based
on milestones.
Okay.
At this point, we're going to be tweaking it as we go. A lot of these things are also kind of like living documents. If we're like, this does not work, we need to get together and vote on it and stuff. We got a lawyer we can call to put it into official legal. We have a very good lawyer who was very into like dorking out about getting all these bylaws in. And we had lots of emails and lots of meetings with ourselves and then also with our extremely great lawyer. And stuff, but like, it's based on like milestones because you have rev share. So like, let's say someone like, let's say everyone gets 15% or something, right? But someone's there up to a certain milestone. They take a certain amount of rev share for what they've done, but we need rev share to be able to give to the next person that comes on and finishes that project. So it gets kind of like divided up like that as we go. And it's something we're gonna be working on as we go because you don't know exactly what your rev share is going to be until you're farther along in the project. Like, we think we're going to end up with 5, but like we might end up with 6, and that changes your percentages, right, of how you're dividing it up. And we might work with a sound designer outside of it, and we might go, okay, well, we need to give them a bit of rev share for how much they're doing. Okay, well, then this. And that's one of those things we have meetings about and talk about. Okay, we can bring on this person. This lowers all of our rev share by 2% or something like that. So, there's rules and laws for it.
I can do the sounds.
Yeah.
So it's like
I can do it. I'm just like beatboxing. And, oh, no.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's once again, it's all like, just talk about it. it's difficult because like we're so used to this idea of like someone has to be the final say to step in when everyone gets unruly or indecisive or something. And
because you hear so many horror stories about when that doesn't happen, especially in AAA, where it's like you really need, like, you have so many strong personalities, like the art lead and the design lead. And oftentimes, even if they're not dicks, like, I think their decisions will sometimes be at odds with one another. Like, the program lead is like, no, we can't support the feature. And the design lead is like, oh, you have to. So it's not, it's hard to not have a creative director.
The part of that, this is me positing.
Yeah.
A lot of those issues are probably handed down from on high. You know, it's a, okay, well, we need to have multiplayer. And a lot of people who are working on the game might be like, okay. And they're like, multiplayer is hot now. We need to put in multiplayer. BioShock 2 needs multiplayer.
Of course.
You know, I don't know anything about the development of that game. Maybe everyone was on board. And there are lots of times when you hear about like studios being like, we wanted to go with another engine, but we couldn't.
We had to use Frostbite.
So we had to use XYZ, and we couldn't. And like all the people making the game on the floor really wanted to move to a new engine, and we couldn't. And that led to all of these problems. A lot of the, I'm just going to posit that a lot of these things that are kind of like life and death, like we need to make a decision and we can't like agree. A lot of those, I think, probably do come down from restrictions and expectations placed on them. So people can't just go, okay, well, you and me talk, what actually works best here? Okay, let's get all of us together and go like, make our case, and then we can like talk about it. And maybe we're going to fight it out, but at the end of the day, we can come to some sort of consensus or at least vote on it. And if you vote on it and everyone's upset, then those people can storm out, I guess. However, they're co-owners in this enterprise.
Right.
So there's a great incentive to find consensus because you got to work with each other or you're cashing out.
That's true.
So that level of accountability is also another huge aspect of a worker cooperative, because it's like, you know, we make things, for example, like layoffs and stuff. If you are making decisions all as people who own the thing, you're not going to make a lot of decisions that could get you laid off at the end of the cycle, right? Like, you're not going to, like, no one is expendable in this, you know, operation, because we all have an equal say in it. So you tend to make decisions that preserve, you know, what you're doing, you know, that preserve your positions. And I don't mean that like in a conservative, like you just make the safest thing possible way. But in the sense of, you know, you are not staffing up past the point where you know you can be sustainable. Which is why occasionally some people, someone's like, you just started with like three people. And it's like, yeah, because we're being really smart about this. Like we are starting out very small and slowly adding people in a way that we know is sustainable, which is maybe what a lot of companies should do.
Well, you guys you're lucky enough to have the funds, right? Like, you guys are self-funding, right? You don't have an outside investor.
For right now, we're eventually going to seek some funding. There's, I'm sure you know, various ways to do that. But not everyone has that to begin with. But that's only an issue if you were like, I want to start a full-time job right now doing this. And most projects can't, and most small businesses can't do that either.
But isn't the one thing that prevents a lot of people from like doing this idyllic system is the outside investors, like, I want a return, whether it's customers via Kickstarter or an actual VC or whatever?
Kind of, but I think we still had those same issues with our last game.
Yeah.
And when you're a small business, that's just...
Yeah, a lot of... a lot of these are just small business problems. Yeah. They're not endemic to co-op problems, you know? It's not as though, like, the cooperative thing is somehow going to endanger your ability to... If you... So the issue with investors, right, is if the investor wants a stake in it, you don't do that, because the whole thing with worker cooperatives is this stays within... The co-op. We do not have shareholders or something like that.
Right. That's however, someone who wants a return.
However, a lot of times when you're a studio, like when you get like funding in, those people don't want to own your shit necessarily. Mm-hmm. They just wanted a return on what you're doing. If you, depending on the amount you get, they might want some hooks in your IP. Sometimes publishers are going to want to own your IP. Mm-hmm. You have to make those decisions when it comes to that. That's something that we're not super into. We're really into maintaining control of our IP.
The only way to get profit sharing is to, keep your IP.
So, I mean, people are going to have to make those like hard decisions on their own. But again, that's just all, you're going to have to deal with that regardless. Mm-hmm. In the cooperative, we just have to make those decisions collectively. And one of our principles is not to have us owned in part or in full by anyone else, because the whole point is that we are trying to avoid sending that money up so that someone gets their cut first and then comes back down. That's like one of the whole points of doing it, is to not do that. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to come to a point where you're like, that would be the one thing that would make this easier. And you'll have to make that decision at that point. But a lot of times when you get like funding in, like for when you're like making a game, a lot of times you get funding in just from like platform holders, right? For like exclusivity or launch it here first, or we're launching a thing, we want you to be exclusive on this for a while. Here's a check.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes you go to someone else and they're like, okay, here's, you know, a couple $100,000 and at the end, pay this back with X amount of interest or something. Those are both really common. So you're not necessarily going to get like acquired by someone partly or fully, and they're not always going to want to like nab your IP. So you're gonna have to navigate like that with anything else, like as with anything else.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, this sounds like a really cool system. It actually reminds me. So I went and visited the people who made Shovel Knight, Yacht Club Games, a couple of years ago, and
that's a good game.
It is a good game. It is a good video game. They do not call themselves a co-op, but when I met with them, the things that they described about their working conditions sounded a lot like what you guys do. Like they were like, everyone has to say yes to a decision we make, and like when they interview people, everybody gets to interview them, and they were all bringing in the same amounts of money. All the co-founders, but one of the problems they were running into was the scaling problem. So I'm curious, you guys mentioned earlier that like there are ways for a co-op to scale. If one day you guys are making Night in the Woods 4 and you're like, we want this to be a third person Unreal 4, whatever.
With multiplayer.
That's Night in the Woods 2, you're just
right, exactly. And you guys want 50 people, how would you go about doing that?
Again, I should point out that's generally not what we're looking to
do. Yeah, no, I'm just curious, but because you mentioned Bethany that there are ways like to scale.
Well, I mean, there's
as a
the
co-op.
Whole thing. There's
if someone out there is listening and they're like, you know what, I want to make a super ambitious game.
And I got 50 people and we're ready to go.
Exactly.
I think like so there are structures. You can actually look them up online too, for anyone who's like curious, the different cooperative structures. I mean, you can have what is essentially a board of directors, but they are voted on by everybody, and they don't have more. They don't have more votes than anyone,
and they don't get more money.
And they don't get more money than anyone. So
the Democratic Republic of co-ops.
Yeah, kind of. And all those people are recallable, and they're not like a, well, I'm the boss of this person, because you can have everyone that works for you go, hi, we need to talk about how you're being an asshole, you know, and how you're not listening to us and that kind of thing. Again, it comes back to communication, where someone can just say, like, there's, you know, less room for grumbling, because you can just be like, hi, I'm coming over to your desk and being like, why are you acting this way? Can you please stop? You know, that kind of thing. So you can do that. You can have different departments be like, oh, yeah, let's say we staffed up and there's like a sound department and an art department and stuff. It's more difficult. You're going to need a lot more internal structures for that accountability, making sure people feel heard, making sure there's communication, so people don't feel like siloed off in any sort of like, well, yeah, I didn't want to do that, but you know, whatever. And it gets difficult because anytime you have more than one person, but it's, how should I say this? The reason why it's not as difficult elsewhere is because no one has a choice about it, right? So like if someone says, oh, hey, you're going here next week. It's easy because you don't really have a choice. You're like, I guess I'm going to, like, how often, you don't have to answer this, but how often are you handed down a decision? You're like, well, okay, well, fuck this. I don't want to do this, but I guess I have to, you know? That's fairly.
If you asked Steven, he would be like, yeah, Jason fights everything I do, but.
The reason why it's easier is because the person below you does not have agency, or not a ton of agency. I guess they can quit, or they can really try to, like, do whatever, but, like, you know, in a lot of people's jobs, their only agency is, do I quit?
Of course.
Or not.
Right.
When you give people extra agency, suddenly there's options and you have to communicate. You have to talk it out. So our whole thing is like, yeah, it gets complicated, but it's complicated maybe in the way that it should be.
Yeah.
Right. No, where it's like a, you know, the only reason this other thing is easier is because we all just kind of factor in our,
that's the
our
way it works.
Yeah. We all factor in getting, for lack of better words, fucked over and not having a lot of agency. Right. We're like, well, that's just how it goes. And so it's easier.
That's just how it's been done.
Yeah. And so it's easier in other ways because you don't have choice and you don't have agency. So, but it's doable, but it's, which is not to say it's all easy. Like, right. Like you go in and it's like, and we all like, you know, because there are going to be times where you have to be like, yeah, this is not working. This person is being a jerk, or we just have really differing visions and we have to communicate. We have to talk and we have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. It's just not that there's one like strata of people that get to make all those decisions for the people below them.
Right.
You know, to be reductive about it. Like So scaling up is possible. It's just you have to build on that level. And there are cooperatives that are huge. Mm-hmm. I think the difference is within a creative process. One of the funny things is when we announced, some of you know, you get the peanut gallery comments from like Reddit and stuff, and someone's like, well, once you scale over five people, you're never going to have a coherent vision. And I'm like, oh, cool, the worker cooperative expert over here. Yeah. This thing that there are like a couple hundred of them in the U.S. and almost none of them doing video games. Yeah. I'm glad that someone has a doctorate in them, though.
It's funny. Yeah. You know, it will be interesting to see. So we have to wrap things up soon. That's cool. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is, so if you're at EA, obviously EA is not becoming a co-op anytime soon.
But never say never.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. Hey, Andrew, how's it going? Yeah. But the actual practical thing to do right now is unionization. And I know you guys are very much in favor of unionization for obvious reasons.
Heard of it.
We're very much. So have you guys seen, from your perspective, doing this thing, any sort of momentum from people coming to you and saying, like, we want to push for unionization in our studios? Have you guys started to hear? Because we're now at the 1-year anniversary of, like, the Game Workers Unite movement starting, and it feels like things have been picking up recently.
Yeah, I'd say.
Have you guys heard any buzz of, like, companies actually starting to make a move?
Yes.
Can't talk about it.
Obviously not. No. Yeah. No. We and a bunch of other game workers, you know, GWU, or as someone was calling it last night, GWU.
Good old GWU.
GWU, which sounds like some like Homestar Runner shit, but it's moving.
Yeah.
It's kind of like there was like a dozen, maybe two dozen of us last year, and it all got put together really quick, but it was just like an avalanche starting. It was like someone, like a lot of these things, we've talked a lot, and I've talked in talks before, like kind of creatively, about the notion of permission, right? Like, not that you need an authority to give you permission, but you need someone to demonstrate that something can be done. Mm-hmm. And then everyone goes, oh, okay, I can do this.
Well,
this is a thing.
That's why we're waiting for the first domino to fall, for the first, like, Naughty Dog or whoever to just be like, we're unionizing and voting.
I'm making a face here, like, that I think that's a likely thing. Yeah. Like, yeah, you've seen it. Like, there's a huge amount. Like, I've been walking around this, and I've had people talk to me. I was wearing, like, a union button the other day, and I'd have, like, someone come up and be like, hey, is that a union button? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh, so you guys are calling for a video game union? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, do you have one? Like, and I'm, like, secretly slipping people stuff. There was a guy I was talking to who has this, let's say, fairly senior position in design at some, like, you know, larger company, who's like, hi, here's my card. Don't email me about unions at this address.
Wow.
You know, we need to talk about this elsewhere. That kind of thing. Like, that's happened
now
several
times.
Now you know
how I feel when I'm secretly talking to them.
it's great. Like, that is, like, occasionally I'll see people being like, oh, this is all just, like, trumped up and everything. And it's like, no, the reason why this is happening, it's not just a bunch of, like, outsider, like, dorks being like, hey, you should all, like, unionize and stuff. It's, like, it's not it's, just, like, us who are kind of like on the periphery of it, but have been in industries that are remarkably similar to games, you know, before we got kind of on like the sidelines of, you know, the larger industry doing what we're doing here. So like we came into this pre-fed up with this kind of like, with the kind of bullshit that happens in games, because games are kind of like a much more extreme version of it, but it's the same shit you see all over the place, right? Like, games aren't exceptional in anything other than scale and intensity.
The volatility seems to be more intense in games than other industries.
Except for media.
Yeah, we're just as bad.
Yeah. But, like, it's definitely grown. Like, that's kind of mostly what I can say about it.
Cool.
Is that, like, even being here, like, you know, GWU, let's not call it that. Game Workers.
Now I'm going to. You know that now, like, Maddie and I are just going to
work on it. We can make that happen.
That's like the Johnny Sun way of saying it.
Yeah. GWU.
I went to a GWU meeting. For some reason. But, like, you know, we've got four, like, the last year, the presence was a bunch of us handing up this pins and stickers and kind of taking over one panel, right? Uh-huh. The IGDA thing. And then this year we have like four official scheduled panels. Like later this week, there's like two round tables and one where there's actual union reps coming from larger unions to be like, all right, here's some next steps, you know?
I think
and
one of our WGA people is going there. Yeah.
And just walking around today, like on our way over here today, while we were walking, we're just walking past Moscone West and there's two guys behind us who were like, oh, blah, 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 went to Tesla because they got burned out or something. And we were like laughing because lol, Tesla. And,
the, yeah, that's a good place to go if you're burned out.
Yeah, it's really, really funny. And then I realized, I'm like, oh, I'm near where Elon Musk is. This is funny to me. And they were like, oh, yeah, I read that, like, expose on, like, labor conditions, and that's like, I guess some people are trying to get like a union going and stuff, and oh, that's interesting. I just like, well, you know, we'll see what happens with that. So like, there is, and I talk to people all over the place and like a bunch of different companies, that some that you would not expect, saying we want to do this, we don't know how yet. Uh-huh. And so that's kind of that's a lot of work that's ongoing right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, this will be an ongoing conversation. But one thing we really have to wrap up, but one thing I should say real quick is that one of the things you guys are doing, that GWU is doing, see, I'm already doing it. GWU is doing is handing out these cards that have pictures of C-suite executives on them and then their salaries.
I wasn't a part of that. So I came here and I'm like, what did you guys do? This is great.
It's incredible because it's like the amounts are just out of control.
Yeah.
I think
the shock
Tim Sweeney's,
that you actually get from people who see it and they're like, no.
Well, yeah. So the one for Tim Sweeney, who's the CEO of Epic, mm-hmm. says $7 billion net worth. Yes, we're serious.
Yeah.
I feel like it should be illegal to
that
have
was,
that.
That was pretty inspired.
It's hard to even imagine. That actually,
I just make like goofy pins and stickers and stuff, and like other people are making these really like hard-hitting bits of like agitprop.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Scott and Bethany. Where can people find you and find your stuff these days?
You can find us at you can find the Glory Society at the Glory Society
on Twitter.
We're you know, we're not announcing something for a while, but we're making some stuff.
Cool.
I'm
people at, will people who like Night in the Woods be delighted by your next project?
Fucking hate it. No, no.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Yeah. Sure, I hope
sure,
so.
Sure.
It's not Night in the Woods 2, but you know, but what is? We're hoping that people like it. And you can find Bethany at
Oh, I'm at Cleo D.
D E E on Twitter, but you don't post
don't
very
really
often because you're smart. You're the smart one of us. And I'm at Bombs Fall, and I tweet occasionally, just about puppies and stuff.
Puppy tweeting. Cool.
Yeah, really casual tweets.
Thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
And welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen's coverage from the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. My name is Jason Schreier, and I am joined once again by Maddie Myers.
Yes, you are.
Hello,
I'm Maddie.
And right now, we are joined by a longtime friend of the show and a guest that we get requests to have him come back. He is the writer and, quote, music and sound person at Zachtronics. Not the audio director. He's the music and sound person. Mm-hmm. Matthew Burns. Matthew, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on again. I think this is like your sixth or seventh time on the podcast, which is great.
Wow.
We've talked about
counting.
So many different things.
Yeah.
We've talked about so many different things over the years. And so just a little bit of context for people that don't know you. You guys at Zachtronics make Zach-style games.
Zach-likes, we like to call them.
Opus Magnum, Shenzhen IO, Space Cam is probably the most famous one. And then most recently, Exapunks.
Exapunks was the most recent one, yeah.
Yeah. You guys do some really cool stuff over there. And yeah, how's your show going? Have you seen anything interesting or done anything interesting?
So yesterday was a bit of a whirlwind for me. I had a micro talk that I was giving as part of the micro talks, and then I had to go from there right to the IGF awards show.
Did you guys get nominated for stuff?
We did. We were nominated for design and grand prize, and we won design. So.
Wow. Congratulations.
Congrats.
That's awesome. Yeah. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, congrats for Xbox.
For Opus Magnum,
Okay.
We make games too fast, so we entered Opus Magnum
That's a common problem, is just making games too fast.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, people always ask us how we make games super
how
fast.
How do you make games super fast?
Well, the games have a lot in common, if you notice. They're all sort of very, very similar in genre. We also just try to like pick something and go with it and make it a game instead of prototyping for a really long time.
Yeah, it's so funny. I've been having a lot of conversations with people recently about endless pre-production and wandering through the desert, people call it, like the endless style of like just sitting in a room and smoking a bunch of pot and being like, what's our game going to be about?
Right. And trying to find the perfect idea, the perfect starting point.
Right.
So you guys just pick something and move full steam ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of our style. We just driven largely by Zach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
really
it helps
likes to
have
fast.
Like, so Zach Barth is this guy who's brilliant, brilliant dude. He's also been on the show before. He's just got this head for this certain type of game. This like, I guess, how would you describe it? System puzzle game?
It's like an open-ended puzzle where you can you're given a challenge, and but you can have these different tools to solve it in a way that works for you.
Sort of like Incredible Machine, the old Incredible Machine games, except a little bit more like...
With more programming.
Yeah, more programming. Often. Yeah. More highfalutin versions of Incredible Machine.
You're right.
So you came in with a shirt that said Speed Tree on it that you wanted to show us. What is Speed Tree?
Well, I just, I didn't specifically.
Oh, like, you just got this.
He doesn't want to tell anyone what it is. It's a secret.
I was just at the Speed Tree booth on the expo show floor.
Okay.
And Speed Tree is a piece of middleware that is sold to other game developers here. This is the kind of thing that goes on, right, at the game developers conference.
It's absolutely fascinating.
You get a free shirt, yes.
Yeah. Middleware. So I was at the Speed Tree booth, and I was there just telling them that I like Speed Tree. Speed Tree is used in almost every AAA game to create the trees. And Speed Tree is, to me, my favorite middleware because all they do is trees. They're not trying to, like, sell you blockchain technology or get you to...
Not yet.
Or not yet, right. Yeah, they're not telling you should put your stuff in the cloud. They're just a bunch of, like... tree nerds like nerding out on making amazing looking trees.
They're and just so, tree nerds.
Yeah. Are they actually tree nerds? Like they really care are. About like, all the no, different kinds
can,
of trees.
You can talk to them about like leaf groupings and like how like the different species.
Is that what you do? You talk to them about leaf groupings?
Well, no, I don't know anything about trees
but they
at
do.
All. But they do, and they're amazing. And it's just to me, it's like I just wanted to be reminded of like the good part of GDC, which is like less like business and more like just wow, trees are cool.
Yeah,
you can do them in
it's
real
so
time
funny.
And
well,
they're so pretty, you know.
It's so funny to think that like you're walking around in this massive Ubisoft open world game and you look over there and oh, the trees were made by this company, and then you look over there and oh, the hats were made by this artist over here.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Exactly. So it all comes, it's all these huge pieces like that come together to make these games. And you know, trees
seems,
are nice, so
seems
like
very
trees.
Sustainable in the long term too.
Well, they've been making trees for generations, like you can see Speed Tree trees in like PS2 games,
really?
PS3 games, PS4
No,
games.
I'm not saying it's sustainable. I'm saying seems sustainable for the AAA productions that are relying on all of these different pieces
well,
to come together.
As long as
they
can get trees.
That's all that matters, No, the trees thing, I mean, the middleware is like, that's
the good thing about
it. Yeah, well, so something that I found super interesting is just this idea of tools and how they can make or break a video game. And you've worked on some games with some rough tool sets. It just feels like this common thing.
Yeah.
And so... it's interesting to see what people are trying to do to solve that problem.
Oh yeah, definitely. You could wander the show floor if you want and like see all the different kinds of technologies that people are trying to sell other game developers, right, to solve all these problems. And every year there's some new thing that they're talking about.
Yeah. Are you guys buying Speed Tree? Are you going to put it in your next
game?
Well,
Zachtronics games
next
are
game?
2D games, so it's kind of easy.
Oh, they don't make
paint.
The little 2D tree
well,
sprites?
I mean... They, you can,
super
right?
accurate.
No,
like
they would
2D.
Tell you like you can make you the, you can render out a 3D tree into 2D. They're happy to do that.
Oh,
but yeah,
cool.
For at Zachtronics we just paint a tree because we just have 2D artists just paint it.
So are you guys doing business meetings at the show, or are you guys meeting with?
Not really.
Because you guys are funded by a totally different company.
Yeah, we're okay as far as like we don't really need to like pitch anything or demo anything this year. So we're here. We came down for the ceremony because we were nominated. And we had a talk. I had my micro talk, and then Zach had a talk that he did yesterday morning, his puzzle design process.
Yeah.
So
what did you talk about?
Yeah. Which micro talk section were you in?
I was in the design micro talks, Richard LeMarchand's design micro talks, and I talked about choice in games the different types of choice and how I kind of my basic argument was that like a lot of people think that like choices need to have big consequences in order to be like good choices. And I was like, you can totally have like a choice that's just for flavor and funny and it doesn't really matter in the end, but that's a perfectly valid choice as well.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah.
Kind of a narrative design sort of.
Yeah.
Thing.
Well, so I went to a panel that was on the making of Divinity Original Sin 2, and that is a game full of choices that are totally just for fun.
Yeah. RPGs have tons of choices like that, like in JRPGs where like, you know, the guy in Final Fantasy VIII who's like, do you like cats? And if you say yes, he's just like, I got a bunch of cats. You know, I mean, there's no meaning to it. It's just funny.
That charm has been missing in some recent JRPGs, especially recent Final Fantasy games. That just like pointlessness, choice for the sake of it.
Right. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's cool. That sounds like a fun thing to talk about. Is that something that you have to deal with in your day-to-day stuff? Because your games have a lot of choices. But I guess you're making another game that you just tease on a little bit, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was definitely thinking about this topic of like choices that don't matter because I've been working on this visual novel project, and visual novels are a genre that do have all of those like kind of choices that don't really matter, but are kind of like, you know, what is your favorite ice cream flavor or whatever? And you just say it and it's like, oh, so-and-so buys you a strawberry ice cream or whatever, that kind of thing.
That's in every visual novel. We're all familiar with that conversation.
The ice cream choice.
It's constantly coming up. I hope that's not in your game.
There's really deep meanings to all the different flavors if you say you like vanilla.
If you pick it in Danganronpa, then you get killed with that type of ice cream.
Is that true?
No, I just made that
That seems. That sounds like something
I haven't played all the Danganronpas yet. Like, you could be not lying to me.
That is true. Ironically killed by your favorite.
So this is something you're working on just on your own on the side for fun?
No, actually, it is going to be, hilariously, it is going to be a Zachtronics game.
Oh, cool.
Sort of, for whatever reason, I was able to convince Zach to this idea that I have, which I can't really talk about yet, but I had this specific idea for a visual novel, and Zach was like, sure, why not? Easy for me to program, you know, thinking of it from a programming standpoint, visual novels are very simple.
Yeah.
So he's just like, yeah, I could write the code for this, you know, in no time. Yeah. So if you want to do it, go ahead. I want to design my own game. So there's two projects going on at Zachtronics right now. One is this game that Zach is sort of in the design space on, which I won't talk about. And then there's this visual novel, which is like I'm working on as from a narrative perspective.
Oh, that's
artists
awesome.
Are going to work on it.
How many people are at Zachtronics now? Like,
Zachtronics is five people.
Five people.
Including
me. Five people making two games.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
What is this world? What is this world of five?
They make games so fast there.
We do try to like make the games fast, and we try to like not get too caught on just like what is the perfect thing and more like just like what is the appropriate thing and what is the right thing. I mean, in the case of the visual novel, like I sort of came up with the full design almost just on paper because it's easy enough to do with that kind of game. Other types of games, you know, you want to do the prototyping and lots of play testing, but like a visual novel, you can almost script out
right
in advance. So that helps with that process.
Yeah, that's true. It's not hard to play tests because you're just kind of figuring out the story beats and like, yeah.
Right. And it's easy to change too. Uh-huh. Like you can change the script to a visual novel pretty drastically and it's usually fine as opposed to like a big AAA game where you have to rebuild all this architecture.
But it takes time to write whole new scenes and...
It does take time to write. And one of the reasons why we're doing the visual novel is because I wrote an enormous amount of it like at home or off time. So
nice. Yeah. So going back to your micro talk, is that like something that you, a challenge that you've been facing as you work on this visual novel is like, how do I put enough choices in this game? When do I put the choices in this game?
Definitely. Yeah. And I'm starting to come around to this idea that like games shouldn't just necessarily put choices in games willy nilly. You should think carefully about them. And I'm sort of like in this mood right now, at least, about like sort of being a little austere with choices and being like, okay, here's a choice and you should just think about this choice. So I spend a lot of time like building up the way this thing is structured is that there's a lot of like setting up what this big choice is going to be. And then there's like a big choice and then it kind of ends after that. So it's more like, what's the most weighty, most interesting choice you could possibly have? As opposed to like 1,000 little choices at any minute, which is like, you know, what weapon should I use? How should I like attack this base or whatever? Instead, it's almost completely the opposite where it's like this linear story that goes on for a really long time. And then it's like, okay, how would you solve this situation?
Interesting. Oh, that's cool. Well, then, I mean, that's like what a good detective visual novel would be where it's like you're discovering all this stuff and then you make a choice at the end.
Right.
Who did it or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Something like that.
So when are you coming out with it?
I think this summer.
Oh, awesome.
So pretty soon.
Super fast.
Yeah. Pretty soon.
Very cool.
Are you going to release a demo of it or you're just going to go ahead and put it out?
I think we'll just put it out. Yeah. I mean,
making games fast, you know?
Yeah. It's what you do. Just put it out there.
Do you think there's something that like AAA can kind of learn from the efficiency that you guys work at? Like, do you think the making decisions just like quickly is part of it or?
I would.
Because you've worked in both AAA and indie.
That's right. Yeah. I think, I would have really liked it if some of the AAA teams that I was on made decisions faster than they did, for sure. Whether that's possible or not, though, is another question. When you have hundreds of people, you want all of those people on board with the choices that you make. And so you either have to like have someone who at the top who's just saying we're doing this, or you have to wait for everyone to slowly get on board with the direction that you're going in. So I think in some ways structurally it's really hard to move at the same speed when you just have a giant team.
Yeah, well, it sounds like what you guys have is a version of the former where Zach is just like, this is the way we're going. And
yeah,
I mean, so it's interesting. So that seems to be such a stumbling block for so many game development studios, is this idea of like not having someone just to crack the whip and like make a decision, which kind of plays into this idea of auteur theory. But a lot of people don't think that auteur theory is like the way like games should be made.
Yeah, it's honestly, you know, very collaborative on our team.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
It's true that like at the end of the day, Zach is the one who's like, yeah, let's do this. But at the same time, we really give each other a lot of room and space. Like anything related to like story and sound and music is pretty much my call. And I'll just tell him what I'm doing and he'll be on board with it. Or sometimes we'll discuss things and say, and, you know, he'll really want something, or he'll say, this is what I was thinking for this thing, and I'll make that work. But I think the real thing is not that he's just like telling us what to do. It's more that just we ended up working well together and we give each other the space. You know, I'm not really telling Zach what to do, like from a design standpoint on the games or anything like that. So we rely on each other and have the trust, right, to like give each other the feedback on those.
Which is obviously
areas.
More difficult when you have 100 people.
But also you were in a situation where you came up with an idea for a game independently and came to him and were basically like, can our studio also make this game? And that was something that was possible, which if he was just like, this is my studio and we're only going to make my games, then that wouldn't be possible. So clearly you do have some give and take.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is really nice.
That's funny. Do you get to crack the whip on the visual novel? Are you the whip cracker?
Not really. I don't, definitely with the visual novel is like interesting structurally because it's Zach's studio, but I'm the one with the visual novel.
The title card should be a Mattronics game.
So on stage last night, Zach went up and said, I'm Zach. And then I went up and I said, I'm Tronics.
Nice.
So that was our stupid bit that we did at the show.
That was cool. So you've been wandering the show floor, talking to people here at GDC. Mm-hmm. Is there anything, we just mentioned Google before we started recording, and you said you don't have a lot to say about that, but I'm curious, is there anything in like when it comes to tech in the future or like innovations or things people are discussing, is there anything you're excited about, like really excited about that's coming?
I kind of don't know what to think about all of it, right? It's just like, the streaming, other stuff in the cloud.
It's weird.
You won't own your games anymore.
That's like scary. You can,
whatever. There's a lot of stuff that I don't know. Maybe it's hard for me to form an opinion on because I just don't really like know exactly what it is yet. Uh-huh. Right. I'm just excited to go home and play Sekiro. That's kind of what I'm looking forward to. The game comes out, Friday, like tomorrow. And GDC ends tomorrow.
Great timing.
I'm just going to go right to the store and buy it.
It did work out nicely.
The second I get home.
We're hearing good things from colleagues who are playing it.
I'm a Souls fan as
I mean, you know that I just got into Bloodborne.
That's
and, like,
right.
Spent my life
right. Congratulations,
Bloodborne.
By the way. I'm finishing Bloodborne.
Congratulations.
I'm very excited.
Yeah.
Although the game that I'm obsessed with now is Baba Is You. Have you played that?
I haven't played it's on my list to check out.
We're going to rave about it next week after GDC.
Jason's an evangelist for it now.
Yeah, nice. It's incredible. I've played it the whole flight here. But it is strange, and it feels like kind of at odds with this idea of like, oh my God, look at all these amazing games coming out now. Why do I have to even think about Google Stadia or whatever?
Right,
But every single company is like, streaming is the future. This is the way we're going.
Yeah. It seems Netflix. Like they're like going to make it happen, it feels like they're sort of jamming it through, right? Whether like people really want it or not, there's just like tons of momentum on it.
But then on the flip side, that kind of happened with VR and it just didn't work.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't jam it through.
And also Google's done this before. Like they really tried to jam Google Plus through.
Yes, that's true. Google Glass.
Yeah. The thing that
and it went great, and we all remember it. We all use it every day.
It's funny. The day after, we spoke to Phil Harrison about how people should trust. So we interviewed Google boss Phil Harrison on the podcast, and he was talking about how you can trust that.
Yeah. We brought up Google Plus.
We're going to stick with this.
Well, so the day after that interview, I got an email saying your Google Plus account is shutting down. Like, here's how to back up your data.
Uh-huh. Amazing.
It was good timing.
Was it from Phil? Just personally emailing you?
Phil was like, hey, just
shutting that down. Yeah. I love that everyone is giving Google crap for shutting down their products, mm-hmm. and everyone is just like, so what happens to my games on Google Stadia?
That's a big question.
In 2 years when you decide to shut it down? And I feel like that is something that Google has been building up, that like reputation for shutting stuff down mm-hmm. has been building up for like a decade, because I remember like Google Wave and mm-hmm. like these other things. They're just
Google
like
Reader.
Reader, RIP Google Reader.
I use
Reader.
That all the time.
Right, yeah. And it was like so, you know, annoying and that they can do this, and now they're just getting all this like massive like wave of people asking them, like, and they have to be like, no, we're really gonna stick to
yeah
it,
right? I mean, yeah, I don't know how satisfying the answers were, but it'll be interesting to see. Game Pass, though, to Microsoft's credit, seems to be like really popular and really working for well for a lot of people who want to just spend $20 a month or whatever it is and get anything that's on it, which is a cool idea.
Yeah, so this whole like sort of Netflix for games. I think you're not supposed to call it Netflix for games. No one wants to say the word Netflix for games, but like,
and
that
yet
kind
it's
of,
all I've heard.
That's,
all week.
That's what it is, right?
The
that's
informal, exactly informal version.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Spotify for games is usually the comparison are making.
That's
but not favorably, because Spotify artists get fractions of pennies.
Right. Yeah. That's Spotify for games would definitely like make me concerned, right, mm-hmm. as a developer, like, I'd be like, oh, Spotify. Right?
Well, that's what people are concerned about with Google. Like, everyone I talked to is the developer is like, how are people going to make money with this thing?
And they haven't really talked about that
part,
right?
They're still keeping it all I guess maybe they've talked about it in private conversations, but they haven't said anything publicly.
Right, yeah. It definitely feels like there's a lot of interest in kind of changing the model for how games are sold, and even not even just with the subscription and streaming things, but also other stores like the Epic Store and other stores trying to come for uh-huh. Valve's territory uh-huh. and things like that. So uh-huh. there's just a lot of turmoil and change in the air for like how people will get their content in the future. And for someone like me who's a developer, I just want to ensure that like I can continue to like make stuff that people will buy and sustain, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. give me a job that I can.
Yeah, it's interesting because not a ton of people know what Zachtronics games are, but you guys have this like active audience that supports you guys, and like you guys are able to keep making games and profit, and it's cool to see. It's cool to see like a niche find its audience.
Yeah, and we don't do anything fancy. We just sell the games.
Yeah, just say hey, here
you
it
sell
is.
Them on the internet.
We just sell. We just use the internet and sell copies of our games. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
is like quaint now.
It feels like
well, what would really be quaint would be if you were burning them to CDs and selling them. Mm-hmm.
That's true. And mailing them.
Yeah, yes. At least you're digital only.
Have you considered doing that? But like the Netflix for games, but with mailing people CDs?
We love physical stuff. You know, Tech made an old Zach wrote like a Windows 95 program and mailed it out on floppy disks to people at one point and stuff.
That's
like
fun.
That.
Yeah. It's cool to see something as a physical item again. It's kind of fun.
Absolutely.
It's a somewhat maybe unpopular opinion that I have is that it's cool to just see something on a physical object.
Totally. No, I think that's why people still release albums, right? On vinyl or cassette tape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if that'll be like, it'll be quaint to release your game on CD in a couple of years.
I think it will be.
Like,
yeah.
It'll be like the equivalent of
vinyl. It already
kind
of is, yeah.
Yeah, well, already you have companies like Limited Run who are just like making it their business to sell these physical copies to people who want them as like limited edition items. But I wonder if that'll be the case of like Activision games.
Oh,
EA
that would
games.
Be weird. How I weird would see be? Indies doing it where they're like, well, you know, we're selling our game online,
well,
but wouldn't it be
that.
Fun to make a version of it on CD or whatever?
Yeah, that's what they do. But it'd be interesting to see if EA and Activision are like, that's the boutique version is like the limited edition. They start a Kickstarter. EA starts a Kickstarter for a limited edition version
like
of Battlefield 6.
Blu-rays that you have to install.
Yeah. There's the enhanced edition also. It's like the Lord of the Rings box set. It's for a video game.
Right. No, totally.
Well, so is there tech that you're actually excited about that's like out there that's like coming that's like middleware stuff other than Trees, which doesn't seem to be
well,
a
Trees
thing.
Is just like a fun aside.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot of for me as like someone who writes and does narrative design, like there's a lot of tools on the horizon that are promising to bring like AI into the loop of like conversations and chatbots and things like this. So it's like
and they're promising.
Well, I don't know that they're like, some of them are like, they're just like tools that you can use. You know, I wouldn't say that there's one that I've seen that has like blown me away. Like, wow, this is really going to change everything. But it has gotten me started thinking about like, okay, so if I made something like this, how would I use it? What would be an interesting use of these types of tools? They're really trying to like push that as like a thing that, you know, that you can use it, put in your game and make the characters more responsive.
Interesting. Or, that's also creepy. Yeah. Well, as a writer, doesn't that bother you a little bit? That like that
you're going to be replaced by a robot
who's
cooler than you and funnier and stuff?
Bothers me.
Do you genuinely feel that a robot could like?
Jason, I don't think what you do could be replicated by an AI.
That's not the no. But it's like the idea of AI is just doing any of this stuff is like weird.
It is weird, and this is actually something that comes up in the visual novel that I just told you about. Which is kind of the question of like what should AIs do and what should people do? And maybe there are things that even if AIs can do them, maybe AIs are not good. It's not good for an AI to do them, right? And those things might be things like generating stories and like, you know, talking about personal stories or like other like personal things maybe are not the best use of things like AI, right? I don't know. But that is a question that comes up and something I've been thinking about.
So I had drinks with someone at GDC last year who like left the games industry to start an AI company, which I guess is tangential to the game industry. But he was talking about how like if people don't start putting in ethical, like asking ethical questions and putting in ethical guidelines, then like in 15 years, the AIs are literally going to be dangerous. Like they are actually going to be dangerous to us in a way that like a sci-fi novel would predict. I was like, okay, I'm going to go now.
And also, can you terrified. Stop yeah. making what you're making,
yeah,
sir?
Also, please stop this. I was terrified. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
That was just a spooky story that you told us.
Soon your visual novel. No, the point is that soon the visual novels will be real life.
Oh no. No, I don't know if I buy that. I mean, I do think there should be ethical guidelines, but I think the concerns that I have about AIs are more about like the literal people's jobs getting replaced concern. And then there's no way for people to make universal basic income currently. So it's like, well, we're automating everyone's jobs. More money is being made from these robots that we built. But then what are we doing with the money? It's going to CEOs and then everyone.
But what if the robots are so smart that they unionize?
That would be great.
That would be incredible.
If they could unionize for us, can we get the AIs to do that, you guys think?
Or they all, like the AIs are made, they replace all our jobs, and then they pull out like a robot guillotine and they're like, America.
This sounds like a good idea for a game.
The robot union, yeah. Yeah, I could see that. That's an interesting story.
Cool. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been a pleasure, as always. And I hope that everyone checks out Speed Tree, because you got to know how your trees are made.
Definitely.
Are you going to put trees in your visual novel? You should.
There are some trees, but they're painted trees. Yeah. Unfortunately, they're not beautiful, lush 3D trees. But if you do need beautiful, lush 3D trees, Speed Tree.
Yeah.
Speedily made lush trees.
They are speedy, and they are beautiful.
They're speedy, and they're trees.
They are.
Yeah,
they are.
Thank you again, Matthew.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton, Maddie Myers, and me, Jason Schreier. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR One, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen or email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.